All right, our next case is 10-2159, Kimberly Zers, Director of the Department of Commerce versus Kimberly Mayhew, Administrator. And Mr. Kearney, I guess you're the whole show today.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court. The State is here today on behalf of the Division of Securities to ask the Court to vacate the decision below because the Appeals Court never had jurisdiction. For three reasons, the Court should vacate the decision and should not accept the absent appellee's suggestion that it could simply dismiss and leave the flawed decision in place. First, the jurisdictional flaw here was clear and is indisputable. Second, the remedy for such lack of jurisdiction is indeed to vacate, not to leave a flawed decision in place. And third, the decision below so dramatically undercut the Securities Division's power to fight fraud, securities fraud, that to leave it in place when it doesn't have a jurisdictional foundation would severely hamper our ability to fight securities fraud.
Why is this far-reaching? I mean, in this situation, money was used to buy life insurance policies for some beneficiaries. What was even used here doesn't even approach the amount that was alleged to have been stolen. Am I correct?
It is correct. There was about less than $1 million spent on premiums, and we're not sure about where the other 10, 12 million of defrauded funds went.
Right. I think substantially less than $1 million for premiums.
Yes, but if the proceeds are available, which is an issue not before the Court.
Well, let's not even talk about the proceeds, because I don't even know that that is any relevance here. Whether it was a dollar or $10 million. I mean, we're talking about the actual hard dollars that were used to purchase these items, which were insurance proceeds. So the question is, how does this impact the bigger picture? If we say that there is no jurisdiction to go after the proceeds of the insurance policies, how does that impact the abilities of the State here?
Because, Your Honor, the Second District ruling that's on appeal here has nothing to do with insurance. It said as a bright-line rule that the Securities Division cannot sue third-party non-violators who are holding money. Their decision was not based on the insurance scenario here or the dollar amount. So that means, for example, the several federal cases we cited involve people where there's no death, no insurance, just flat out, the SEC has come after me or the Ohio Securities Division is coming after me. Here, honey, hold my $10 million and, you know, everybody's scot-free. You can take it to Switzerland overnight. You can go to the Caymans. You can move the money. You don't even have to move yourself personally. And so the Court of Appeals decision says, per se, the Securities Division simply cannot sue others, no matter how much money they're holding, no matter how clear the fraud is. As long as we can't show that that person also committed fraud, we just can't touch them. And that is a wide and sweeping ruling that would have harmful effects if it stays in place.
Well, it's really an interpretation of the statute, though, Mr. Kearney, because the statute says in 1707 that the individuals involved, the wife, the son, and the secretary who received insurance policies with premium dollars allegedly taken in the fraud, were not agents, employees, partners, officers, directors, or shareholders of the violator. And so it's a strict statutory interpretation.
Well, Your Honor,
And I guess the question I have for you is, it seems like the individuals involved, the wife, the son, and the secretary, don't fit into those categories. And so to that extent, we could say we have a correct determination from the appellate court. But your argument seems to talk past that with a different section of the same statute that says that the director or the court may make such orders and get such other equitable relief as the facts may warrant. And so it seems as though there's two separate determinations in different parts of the statute. And you're arguing to us, I think, that there ought to be the ability to obtain equitable relief as warranted by the facts against those persons.
against anyone, Your Honor. And our
including
view is...
Including the wife, right. The son,
correct.
And the secretary. Is that your argument?
Yes. We believe that the such other equitable relief clause is not limited by the laundry list of specific violators and agents for several reasons.
So we have a statutory interpretation question as to the impact or the meaning and the breadth of the language, such other equitable relief as the facts may warrant.
That is the merits, and I want to answer your question on that, but also note that the other side, although not here, agreed in their brief that the merits are not before the court and that the procedure below was flawed, and the only question was what remedy to do about that flaw. So I want to get back to that procedure. But on the merits, as you noted, there are two different clauses, and the first clause says that a court shall grant an injunction against this set of people for whatever injunction is needed, anything involving the fraud or acts in furtherance. So the next clause then goes on and says, and such other equitable relief as the facts warrant. And in our view, that such other equitable relief has to cover other people because you've already got injunctive power. It's not like the first clause was limited to damages or restitution like other parts of this chapter. The first part already gives you injunctive power against all those other folks. So to reach others, such other equitable relief would have no meaning. And there's a difference between may shall, that the court shall in the first, and may if we've proven our case. If we don't, then fine. That's a case-by-case determination we entrust to trial courts, and it gets reviewed for abuse. But the point is the power's there. In particular, here, this is a perfect example of where there's ambiguity. You read it in pari materia with 0.27, the next section that talks about once a receiver's appointed, which happened here and is now happening in the lower court, the receiver's fighting the defendants, a receiver is allowed to trace property that's commingled, do everything. It makes no sense to have a receiver have all this broad power to trace any property, whereas at the first step, we can't even freeze it. So as soon as we go in and file, even if a receiver is appointed within days, which normally happens in every
case. But you can still have a receiver to investigate the finances of the enumerated parties or the enumerated individuals in 0.26.
Right. But our fear is, and I think it's borne out by what happens when people know securities or other law enforcement is closing in, is if the receiver is appointed, even if it's within days, as normally happens, you're publicizing a roadmap for, oh, just give the money between when the division comes after you and the receiver, and it's all gone. I do want to turn
your argument is that the trial court has the power to immediately issue an injunction mandatory under the first section, but discretionary under the second to
correct.
Freeze those assets, give the receiver time to get appointed, as was done here, and
correct.
Then the receiver sorts it
right.
out.
Right, and then everyone could fight with the receiver. And the asymmetry here is if you leave this decision in place, people have a roadmap for the money to escape before the receiver
right.
comes
counsel,
to the
has this ever been applied to a situation such as this, or is it usually to financial institutions that are actually holding instead of folks like the wife, the son, and the secretary?
Well, yes and no. We have in other receiverships collected money, including life insurance proceeds from other family members or other. We've never had a situation like this where a court like the Second District has said you can't go after third parties at all. And the problem is because these are usually preliminary injunctions, if they're preliminary for a few days and then the receiver comes along and you fight with the receiver on the merits, even if a court somehow ever went overbroad, a short-term injunction over millions of dollars doesn't really harm anyone. They can still live in the ensuing days or weeks. And on the other hand, if you publicize this decision or leave it in place, it is a roadmap for how to get your money out of town. All these other folks, most people consent to a receiver. Most things are decided within a week or a month. This is the only receivership I'm aware of where it's gone past a month before we've gotten a receiver out of the dozens over decades. And I think that's because most people recognize the fights with the receiver. So I want to turn, if I may, to the procedural flaw here, because however bad this decision is on the merits, everybody has now agreed that there was a flaw. The other side, the only one who filed, has said, this was a preliminary injunction. This was just, can you do this in the short term? A final order then comes along that supplants that and doesn't impose anything in favor of the division. It does say some things about receiver. It does move on and do other things. So that fight was over. And that is flawed in several distinct ways. The first and most important is this court just reaffirmed a few weeks ago in Merrill, the Lake Erie case, that you have to have appellate standing, not just trial standing, but that appellate standing requires that you show you were aggrieved by the order you're complaining of, And the court went on in paragraph 27 to stress that that standing must be satisfied before reaching the merits. Not may, not discretion, must be. And here, she attacked the final order, but what she really wanted to attack were some preliminary injunctions that were gone. There's nothing in the final order that continues a .26, a 1707.26. So it was gone. Even if you were to generously read it as she were somehow trying to attack the preliminary injunction, that's moot. That's gone. A preliminary injunction, not just by operational law, but in the terms here, had gone away.
Counsel, so, let me understand that argument, because I was a bit unclear about that. There is your argument that when it gets to the Court of Appeals, there is no restraining order against anyone, therefore that issue is gone? Is that
correct? There was no restraining order under .26 in the division's favor. It's unclear, and not before the court, whether there was no injunction at all in any way, shape, or form, or whether there was a limited injunction by the receiver against them.
Yes, I was a little unclear about that, too.
Right.
But we don't need to.
We don't need to, because any injunction that may have existed was only between her and the receiver under .27. But the appeals court goes on and says, oh, the division can't do this under .26. So the division, the court was reaching a fight about the division's power that had already gone by the wayside. And we tried to tell the court this was moot. The court didn't address it in its opinion at all. I'm not sure why. But in retrospect, I think it's not only moot, but the better way to phrase it is that because they targeted only the final order, that the appellants actually don't have appellate standing, in this court's words, from St. Gabriel, or from State Ex Rel Gabriel, and in Merrill, and in a series of cases, that you simply have to be aggrieved by the order. When you say, I don't like that final order, well, what does it do to you? Well, nothing. I really don't like the order from a year ago, the preliminary injunction in July 08. Well, first, you didn't appeal that. Second, if you tried to, it's moot, and there's no exception to mootness here. They haven't come forth with any allegation. There's an exception to mootness. And that's why it's important for this court, not just because of the merits of the securities issue, although those are important, just for sheer jurisdictional purposes alone. This court has found exceptions to mootness, but it's never said that there's an exception for lack of standing. It's never said that's waivable, and it's never said we can blow past mootness when no one even makes a case for getting around.
And the appellee agrees with you.
Well, I want to be honest on their behalf. They're not here. They do, but then they sort of half take it back. On the first point, whether there was nothing below, they say, yes, well, there might have been this one thing where we had good faith about the separate dispute we had with a different insurance company. Well, that doesn't create a dispute with us. And then they do say conditionally, well, if there was no jurisdiction below, then, yeah, you should vacate. But then they step back and at another part in their brief say, well, you know, you could just dismiss because they're both flawed, so which way you do is sort of six and one half dozen of the other. In our view, no, that's not the case. This court said, for example, in State Mutual Insurance Company versus Titanium Metals, this court recently said when there was no final appealable order below, we vacate the decision below, not we just throw it out and we leave things be, because that would be rewarding not only, you know, an appellate flaw below, but appellees who don't show up to make the case by just saying, well, could be this, could be that. It would be harmful for this court's jurisdiction to tell appeals courts that these things can just be overlooked.
So, Mr. Carney, is the whole question here, I mean, how do we write an opinion based on what you're talking about with a procedural flaw? It seems to me that you're suggesting the case just be vacated for lack of appellate standing.
Correct.
And nothing more, because
right.
Everyone's talking about these merits, whether we should even reach them. And your suggestion, we were to say vacate.
Right. Simply repeat the standard you've said before, vacate for lack of appellate standing.
And that would do it.
One paragraph. If there's any doubt on the court's part about whether it's lack of standing versus mootness, you could say lack of controversy, you know, no justiciable controversy below, and you know, remain somewhat agnostic. We think the best view is lack of appellate standing, but whether it's mootness or any other, you know, lack of final order because it was a preliminary injunction,
so
there was no jurisdiction.
The lack is because they didn't initially appeal the injunction.
They did attempt to, and as the court notes in its footnote, the court threw that out on its own as not a final appealable order.
Exactly.
And it wasn't, because it just said, hold your money for a few days. It didn't do anything irreversible, no egg that can't be unscrambled or bell that can't be unrung. It just said, hold steady. It didn't do anything concrete to them that couldn't be reviewed later, or ends up a harmless thing because we didn't get a permanent injunction. And a lot of
there ambiguity in the statute between the designation of those categories of persons, agents, employees, partners, and the catch-all phrase about the ability to seek other equitable relief as the facts warrant.
I see my time is up, even with no opponent. I've gone over time, but if I may briefly answer. The distinction is, first, the first clause does say a court shall enjoin the listed people. And then it goes on to say, and may give such other equitable relief as the facts warrant. And so our view is, when you're into the discretionary may jurisdiction of the court, then yes, you're no longer limited by that laundry list.
Then to pick up on Justice Lanzinger's question, is there need for us to clarify the authority of the division to act? Or are you just asking us to vacate this and not write any opinion? Or what are you asking us to do?
To vacate. And I wish I could say yes, Your Honor. If this court sees a way to reach the merits, we would love to have a state Supreme Court ruling that affirms our power so it's never questioned again. But I'm compelled, you know, as an officer of the court, to say when we see a jurisdictional flaw and it's not even debatable that you have to cut out not only this case but cut out the decision below because there's no jurisdictional basis. If the court disagrees with me on that and sees a jurisdictional route that I don't see and that the other side can't point out, then we would welcome a ruling.
Would this be a case that we should say that it was improvidently allowed?
Not at all, Your Honor. That would be the worst thing to happen, because that is basically leaving in place a flawed decision, which goes against what this court has done in appellate standing. It goes against what the court has done in vacating cases that were flawed below, and it ends up rewarding and leaving in place this bad decision, and then it carries all those harmful consequences, and it'll be hard for us to get a case back up, because normally, because these are not as quickly reviewable, because people consent and we move on and the real fight's with the receiver, it'll be hard for us to ever get out from under this decision. And you've got a published roadmap of, do you want to hide the money? You got a free couple days. Go for it. And that's obviously...
Counsel, isn't there always a receiver appointed in these circumstances?
As far as I'm aware, I think in theory, if there were simply restitution of one pot of money and you just give it back and there's no accounting to be done. But generally speaking...
Well, in these situations that you're concerned with is the equitable ability, the relief to go after the hidden, because you're not talking about the straightforward, couple designated individuals in the statute. You're looking at the bigger picture that might be a little more secretive and clandestine in the wrongdoers.
Right, where the money's
squirreled protection.
Away.
Right. So there's always going to be a receiver there.
I think so.
So the fight is always going to be with the receiver, not with what the department's doing.
Right, unless the fight with the receiver becomes a nullity, because during that brief period where the division comes in, if there's this roadmap for how to hide the money, it's not worth the receiver to chase if there's no money there to chase anymore. So, yes, the fight will be with the receiver.
And so the argument here is the ability for the division to get the injunction to begin with.
Right, just to hold steady till the receiver arrives.
And if we let this go, okay, now I...
Right, then bad things happen, et cetera. But again,
all right,
please vacate the decision for lack
Thank
of jurisdiction.
You.
Thank you.
Thank you. Marshal, will you call a recess?